Judge Breslow, how do you feel about law in motion arguments by counsel on summary judgment motions or motions to dismiss or change of venue? Do you think those need to be in person?
Sure. So here's the answer. It depends. Example yesterday, very well established, prominent law firm from the South. City attorney's office here from the North. Dispositive motion, oral argument, been set for months, hours of preparation, hours of judicial preparation. I told counsel that I was happy to conduct the hearing virtually to save time and money for the side that was out of town. So we had yesterday a 1 hour motion to dismiss hearing, and I sat right here in my chambers. Easier to see on this computer than out in the courtroom. And it was fine, other than the 20-minute loss of connection. Long answer. Short version, Your Honor, is I'm not adverse to that. If the quality of justice is not diminished by lowering the cost and increasing the access. Yesterday, it worked fine. It should continue to work fine. I am not against effective, cost-saving, more convenient ways for matters to be heard and properly addressed. Judge Dollinger gave an example of multiple benefits to having virtual advocacy on matters he hears. I have absolutely no qualm with that. I'm also the backup probate judge, and I'm well aware of the utility of having probate hearings virtual, and I'm strongly in favor of that continuing. And just like Judge Clark Newberry said, the litigated probate matters, some of them I do virtually, some of them attorneys come into court. It's sort of a case-by-case basis. But so that my simple answer, Your Honor, is it depends, but I'm not against, nor do I think anyone should be against effective advocacy virtually if it can save money and get us to the same place.
Unlike, I lose track of this. Is the eight still doing law in motion calendars every day, and the second is not, or what's happening there in civil cases? Do you have
Second
one?
is not, Your Honor, to my knowledge.
And Judge Newberry, are you doing oral arguments on all motions in civil cases?
Yes, we predominantly each department sets their preference or their preferences with master calendar as to matters that will be heard in chambers versus those that are set for oral arguments. So it's by category. So we all have lists with master calendar that says, for example, a default judgment under a certain amount does not get set for hearing unless it's specifically requested by the parties in their caption. Then there are other types of hearings that are automatically set for hearing, but pursuant to our local rule, upon our review of the briefing, we can make a determination that an oral argument is not necessary and issue a minute order rendering a decision based on the briefing.
Okay. Let's turn to tab three, which is the list of criminal case types and the boxes that were checked there. Right out of the chute, we have a difference of viewpoint about arraignments, I guess.
No, I'm sorry, Justice Hardesty. I probably should have included a more complete explanation. Where our committee was unanimous on everything. So we divided certain types of hearings up, but where there's an X, that's what our committee is unanimously recommending. So we unanimously recommend that a general arraignment can be presumptively virtual, but if it's going to involve a guilty plea, then it's presumptively in person. Gotcha. And so that's why we kind of took general motion practice involving presentation of witnesses and evidence, and kind of divided them all up by that way. But I was really proud of my committee because we kind of tried to take that 30,000 foot view of realizing we're talking about just general presumptive recommendations, understanding that the judge or any of the litigant or the attorneys can ask for something different. For instance, to Judge Breslow's point, if you have a civil motion or a criminal motion for that matter, and it's presumptively virtual, the judge in reviewing things could say, I got a feeling I'm going to have a lot of questions on this, and there are some complexities here, and I'm going to reach out to the attorneys and say, I want to do this in person, so I'm going to want you all to come on into court. Or the attorneys can view something as presumptively virtual and say, you know what, I would really like to be in court on this one. Doesn't mean both sides have to be there, but they're certainly always free to come there. But we're just talking about, you know, when a presumption should be in place for virtual court that's of benefit to the attorneys, the litigants, and criminal, obviously, one of the focuses we had was, you don't want people, particularly indigent folks that maybe are working, to have problems with their jobs by having to come into court all the time. And I know that I had the experience once COVID started, and I think Tierra would back me up on this, that we actually had more criminal defendants appearing for court when they started being able to appear virtually versus in the past when it was all in person and we're issuing bench warrants or continuing matters because people aren't showing up at all. So we were kind of trying to stay at a 30,000 foot view on all of that as we were working through everything. But if you're looking at our chart, there's an X in a box, that's a unanimous recommendation that that's how we want to handle that particular area.
Okay. Any comments or questions or differing points of view on that list?
This is Jonelle. I had, it was a great committee, and I agree, we were unanimous on much of it. Are on all of it. As I've been thinking a little bit more, I had one more thought, and it was inspired by my request for a $25 fee from my college student for a test monitoring program that when she takes a test online, they have a monitoring program that sees, is someone else in the room giving her the answers? Is she got notes that she's cheating off of? And I'm wondering, in cases where a witness does testify virtually, if there might be something like that, because one of my concerns about virtual testimony is someone coaching them off screen? Do they have notes that haven't been disclosed to the attorneys? Those things that you can observe in a courtroom that you can't do virtually. And you know, maybe the answer is going to a librarian and having her look around the room and promise no one else is in there giving the answers. But I know that's more in the weeds than the 30,000 foot view, but I do think we need to secure the integrity of testimony if it's going to be virtually in a way that doesn't just happen. You know, I could have someone on the other side of my screen, none of you would know. I think we need to have some mechanisms in place for testimony.
If I may add one comment as well, the recommendation seems sound. The one, however, that did give me a pause was sentencing hearing involving out of town or out of state defendant with a stipulation to probation. Of course, that means a joint recommendation. Parties can't stipulate, but they can jointly recommend. So I know what's meant here, or statutorily mandated probation. What I would say is if you commit a crime in Nevada, if you're allowed to go back to Boston or go back to Topeka or go back to St. Louis, when you're sentenced, you're sentenced in my courtroom. Reason, I may not follow the sentencing recommendation. I may not follow the stipulated or the joint recommendation for a suspended sentence. And I have had several cases during COVID where somebody was being sentenced other than in the courtroom, and they were sentenced to incarceration and they fled including very serious crimes. Indeed, I had somebody flee who then is alleged to have committed another crime while on the run and was recently apprehended and is now set for an open murder case. So I want to make sure there is no scenario where somebody who may be taken into custody as a result of the sentencing hearing is not here. And so with all due respect to the excellent work, I would say that that should not be presumptively virtual just because they're out of town, notwithstanding a joint recommendation. If there's a statutorily mandated diversion or suspended sentence, maybe, but even a statutorily mandated suspended sentence may involve jail time as a special condition of probation. So the same concerns there would still apply. So if the subcommittee is going to take another look at this at some point, I would just ask that those comments be considered. Thanks.
Any reaction now to those observations? Judge Jones, how are you doing?
Well, I think one of the things, and I'm sorry, I have been here, though. I just didn't have my camera. I
saw your name up there.
Yeah, I just didn't have my camera. But I mean, I think when we discussed that as a subcommittee, the comments that were brought up by Judge Breslow, the reason we said presumptively is because the presumption is a lot of times that if that's going to be followed, and I think it goes along the lines of what Justice Herna just said. The reason we said presumptively is because when the judge is prepping their calendar, I mean, I know for me, if somebody's going into custody, usually I know before they know that they're going into custody, the judge has every right to call the parties and say, this needs to be done in person. I've actually done that. I did it during COVID and I've done it recently where somebody appeared on Blue Jeans and I said, we're going to continue this and I want you and your client to be here in person because then somebody can be remanded or whatever it is that you're going to do. And I think when we put that presumption on there, it was like presumptively the judges are following negotiations or things in this situation, that would be the presumption. But we said presumptively because the judge always has the ability to say, I want you guys here on this case.
Sure.
Yeah. And we discussed a lot of the anecdotal things like Judge Breslow is referring to. But I also know that during COVID, when I was sentencing people in absentia that were remote, PMP, I believe, had developed a program or a protocol where they were able to, get with people by telephone that were being put on probation and arrange times for them if they needed to actually come in person to then go down there in person. I also had people where I would review the sentencing and I would reach out to the attorneys ahead of time and say, I need this guy to come into court and I need you to come into court with them so we can have a discussion. Some of those people got remanded and went to prison. Some of them, in my personal interactions with them in court, I decided to take the chance and still put them on probation. And then I had people that I sentenced to prison who were appearing remotely and gave them a surrender date to show up at the Clark County Detention Center and surrender. And I never had a person back out of that. And part of what I would tell them was, I'm reserving the right to revisit your sentence if you don't show up on this date to surrender yourself to start serving this prison sentence. So I think part of this is just we have to break out of the mold of our old preconceptions about what we expect of people and be willing to be a little more creative in how we're handling certain situations. I completely understand Judge Breslow's concern. And that's why we were trying to fashion that particular topic as something that only would apply if somebody was out of state or out of town. And we were trying to save costs and jobs and travel and all that in the first instance, understanding that if in that first instance the judge has any concerns, then you can continue the sentencing over and have them show up in person. Or you, like I said, reach out to the attorneys ahead of time and maybe just turn it into an in-person hearing. Given that person a chance to travel and come to court and appear in person.
Okay, any other comments or questions about the list associated with criminal cases? All right, let's turn to the family law area. Very detailed. Judge Dollander, you want to offer an overview or any comments, and then we'll reach out to others.
Sure. Similar to Justice Herndon's description, the X's in the respective boxes means we came to a collective agreement as a group subject to the comments. You'll note under adoptions, it was undecided, and then in the comments, judge's discretion. For adoptions, in terms of judge's discretion, I always defer to the adopting family. A lot of times they want them in virtual because they don't want to deal with bringing everyone to court. They have plans for the day to go celebrate. I've actually had more requests for virtual adoptions than I have in person. But if the family wants in person, then we do it in person. So I think how a lot of the family court judges are doing adoptions. And I think the families really appreciate that, giving them that choice. All of the trials, presumptively in-person evidentiary hearings, orders show cause, termination of parental rights trials, of course, and then on settlement conferences, the judge having discretion and really in consultation with the parties on that, not just making a unilateral decision. Dependency cases, having certain hearing types within dependency cases, presumptive in person, and then some presumptive virtual. Delinquency, you'll see a little bit of a difference where more are presumptive in person. Again, kind of going back to the desire for increased formality in those cases for obvious reasons. TPOs and taking into consideration sensitive issues of domestic violence. The ex parte apps are kind of a no-brainer where those are virtual, any unopposed motions virtual, and then the extension hearings are presumptive in person. Consensus on specialty court hearings in the family court arena, having those presumptive in person, and then if someone's really doing well or in an advanced phase, to use a virtual appearance as an incentive and to for their good progress, but also having the judicial officer having the discretion for if we really want that person to maintain their job, which is a huge focus in the family court cases, and their income, then allowing virtual appearances sort of on a case-by-case basis. The 8th Judicial District has the day court, the detention alternative for autistic youth court, and those would be held in person regardless of progress. And then you can see the minor guardianship and adult guardianship, mostly are presumptive virtual. And then mediations in the 2nd have been being held mostly virtually, although we're giving the mediators discretion to make that decision. For the most part, they're doing them virtually, but in some cases, when they talk to the parties and counsel, sometimes there's really good reasons to have it in person, and so they have that discretion to do that in our jurisdiction. We also identified just there at the bottom the 2 bullet-pointed issues. When you have hybrid appearances, how breakout rooms can be utilized. So just problem solving around the technology there. And then also, and this is an important one, ensuring the confidentiality during virtual hearings. So of course the dependency cases are confidential. What I've been doing is just, and it's probably imperfect, but I canvass folks, like the parents that are appearing, or you know, alone. Oh, I mean, I have a ton of people who appear from outside at the park. They're homeless. They're taking a 15-minute break from their job and they're in their car. And I just ask them the questions and I explain the confidential nature of the hearings. And I sometimes I'll ask them to show me with their camera, like show me that there's nobody else in your car, you know, and that seems to work okay. Although I really liked Ms. Thomas's idea, and that's maybe something that we could look at as an option, just to have that extra layer of protection in these cases. But I think that's it for our subcommittee.
I really appreciate the detail of the work. Are there other members of your committee that would like to comment? Any lawyers who want to comment on this?
I don't think they're here today, because it was Judge Hill and Judge Burton, and then Almeida was helping us, which we really appreciated. But it was, we had a small subcommittee.
And this is all the work product unanimously of your group, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Any comments or questions by attorneys on the committee?
So I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
In theory, I agree with most of this. I'm just wondering why there was a differentiation between 432B guardianship citations and the minor and adult. So for 432B, it's in person presumptively, but for adult and minor, it's for virtually presumptively.
So I think in the second, the guardianships are done all in Department 14. We're not doing those out of the 432B cases. So I think that came from Judge Burton and Judge Hill. So I'm not quite sure. I'm sorry, I can't answer your question today.
Okay. And I only say that because in 432B guardianships, those are the cases where you do have much more difficulty getting people in person. You know, you have a lot of kinship guardianships where they need subsidy or they're taking four buses for a 15-minute hearing. So I just didn't know if there was a specific thought process behind why those were presumptively in person.
How are they being done in the eighth now?
They're being done, it depends on the judge. So some judges are requiring everybody to be in person, the attorneys, the guardians, the children, and then other judges are doing it by virtually. So it's, which is a shame, again, only because it's a hit or miss. So if you don't know which judge you have, and then trying to figure it out and try and make sure that these people, again, that have to take, you know, two or three or four buses to get there, and then the attorney needs to be down there, it's causing quite a few issues. And I would think, if anything, especially 432B would be presumptively virtual.
Well, let me add one point to what you just said, Audrey, and that is, I think we all on this committee need to be mindful of the practitioners. I have heard over and over and over again all year from practitioners throughout the state, the frustration they have at the rules that are different department to department, departments within the same district. That's just not workable. Now, I recognize that some things need to be discretionary decisions, but I think having a situation, and I recognize this is unique, Audrey, to the point you made to this type of case, but we can go to other case types. We can go to civil cases, criminal cases, where one judge handles it one way and another judge handles it another way, which that inconsistency is just not justified in my mind. And it's unfair to the practitioners to be trying to figure out what the menu is for this, for this case, depending upon the what judge they drew.
And then just so everybody's aware, I see that adjudicatory and plea hearings should be in person. I agree that an adjudicatory trial should be in person. The plea hearings, again, it depends on your judge. Most of us are assigned to a particular track, but sometimes we do get off-track appointments. There are some judges that require the parent, and I understand why they want the parents there for the plea hearing, but they also want the attorney there for the plea hearing. So if I've got a plea hearing in one department where the judge requires me to be there in person, and I've got an off-track appointment, and that judge is doing them virtually, And then I get some snarky comments. It's you know, this is already extremely difficult work. It's supposed to be part-time. It's not, it's full-time. We are dealing with mentally ill, drug addicted and homeless people. And I mean, the work itself is extremely difficult, but then to add this to our plate and say, well, in addition, you've got to try and juggle when you have to be down in person and when you don't. And if you're going to take an off-track appointment or if you have to decline, sometimes I do pro bono guardian ad litem for other judges. I may have to decline because the judge wants me to be there in person in one department. And that's happened actually in my department where guardian ad litems who consistently have been appointed because they are now required to be in person have to decline appointments. So now my client as the parent who needs a guardian ad litem doesn't have a guardian ad litem. It's so frustrating because these are the population that we really need to be considering. It's the hardest on them. They are the homeless. They are the ones taking four buses. They are the ones, you know, that need that representation. And to pigeonhole us as practitioners into this box of, well, I'm the judge, it's my discretion, or I want you to be here in person without considering any of the other factors, even when they're brought forth, is really concerning. And it's not just myself, it's among all of us practitioners who do abuse and neglect. And I also do domestic, I do guardianships, I do mediations, I'm a juvenile dependency mediation. I do those. Those are usually virtually, but we'll do them in person if it's beneficial. So, you know, I do a lot of the things that are on here. And again, just these people are trying to engage in services and I'm sorry. And now I'm getting off on.
That's okay. And you bring up a good point, and it's probably a distinction I should talk about, which is, well, first, obviously you can't be in two places at once and that's not fair to you. I think in the eighth, it's a much bigger issue just because there are so many more judges doing dependency case types. In the second, there's two of us, me and one of our hearing magistrates. And then I just know in our subcommittee discussions and talking with Judge Hill in the rural, it sounded like they were just doing more hearings in person. That's sort of a default. So we kind of, as we started talking about these things, we have really good discussions about it. It does seem like there's a discrepancy. And Ms. Beeson, I'm happy to follow up with my colleagues and then follow up with you directly as to why evidentiary hearings are classified as presumptive in person, but then the 432B adjudicatory plea hearings aren't. In my courtroom, if it's an evidentiary adjudicatory, it's in person. If it's not, which the vast majority of them aren't, they're virtual. But I'll have to circle back with Judge Burton and Judge Hill on that. I don't know if I wasn't there for one of the discussions in that regard. But also, in the eighth, my understanding is that the attorneys that represent the parents in these cases are from the private bar. And in the second, they're all public attorneys. They're all deputy public defenders and alternate public defenders. And I think, so that's all they do in the second. But in the eighth, that's a very different circumstance. Because like you mentioned, you're doing all kinds of different cases, you don't just have a dedicated dependency caseload. And that's something that we as judges have talked about too. So that's a big difference between the jurisdictions.
Anyone else care to comment on the family law list? Okay, let's go to tab 5 and the limited jurisdiction list. Just Tyrell, do you want to comment on that list?
Sure, I wasn't at the April meeting, so I wasn't part of the subcommittee, but as I look on the list and the comments, I find myself falling into the areas with Judges Saragosa and Leung, and I'm thinking maybe it has to do with the caseload differences, that it becomes more difficult for us to have, for example, the preliminary hearings virtual. I have, and my personal experience with that has been trying to even allow certain witnesses to testify, and it's just been very problematic if it is of any length at all. It for either the technology cutting out, or for background noise, or for a variety of reasons. So myself, as well as my colleagues in my court, are very much for requiring in person for the preliminary hearings.
Judge Mathis, do you have an observation about, I guess you're on the other side of the fence there.
Actually, on the preliminary hearings, I am on the side of the fence of them being in person, so I'm not sure.
Okay.
What happened? I'm not opposed to having witnesses appear remotely, but I do not prefer preliminary hearings virtually.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe there's just some problem areas in the way this was entered. We'll have to circle back and check that. Was this? Do you know, Judge Mathis, if this was? It looks like you've got these areas are undecided, and the splits between the judges maybe are not entirely correct.
I think probably a little bit on the undecided goes back to Judge Tyrell's comment that each of our jurisdictions, our caseloads vary so much.
Yeah.
That in some of the real smaller jurisdictions, some of these things are a lot easier to handle. For instance, for 2 years, almost, I did virtual arraignments and I'm in Lane County, so we had very few technical issues, if any. And surprisingly enough, I think out of the 2 years, I had maybe 5 people who did not have the technology to connect, where Judge Tyrell's experience is, if I recall correctly, much different. But I might have 50 to 100 on arraignment count, or 50, let's say, on an arraignment counter. Judge Tyrell may have 100. Correct, Judge, if I recall, Judge Tyrell?
Yeah, some days are incredible.
Yeah.
And I was just going to say, I mean, a calendar doesn't go by in my court where virtual isn't involved. I mean, every criminal calendar, every week, we're doing the arraignment. We're doing some arraignments, some status checks, but they tend to be relatively short. But our court is very much preliminary hearings, misdemeanor trials, and of course, jury trials on the battery DV. We're very strong on them not being virtual.
Sure. Judge Tyrus, did you want to weigh in on this?
Well, I do have a couple of comments. You know, first of all, virtual technology, it's a tool. You know, just like anything else, it can be used for to help us, or it can get in the way. And it's not ideal for all judges and all courts and all circumstances. That's one of the conversations that we had during our subcommittee meeting was speaking to that. And you'll note, if you take a look at the split between the courts, it tends to be the big courts are more inclined to go in person, whereas the smaller courts, the rural courts, tend to have an inclination of wanting there to be a presumption for virtual use. And a lot of that has to do with our isolation, how the smaller courts are much more isolated. It's much more challenging, for us to get everybody into the courtroom on a convenient basis. And so a lot of the discussion and the meeting that I participated in, actually, it was Judge Mathis, it was Judge Bishop and myself, Regrettably, Judge Saragosa and Judge Leon were not there and available, but we found that our positions were, generally speaking, 180 degrees from theirs in terms of what our default inclination was. So just to kind of reiterate, you know, it really is, I think, court specific as to how beneficial this sort of technology can be. The response that we've gotten, and we started with our first virtual calendar in 2019. It was a traffic calendar because we are remote, and because we're a tourist destination, we have a lot of people come in from California. And if they're coming in for a traffic ticket or a parking ticket or something of that sort, the idea of them having to drive 4 hours to say not guilty, turn around and go home and come back 5 weeks later, you know, that was just something that that really bothered me. And so that was why we instituted it. And in situations like that, it's very valuable. There are other times where absolutely I want to have everybody in the courtroom. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. You know, there's a credibility issue, or because person's likely to be remanded and they're a flight risk, or, you know, other situations like that, I absolutely want them to be in the courtroom, and I exercise my discretion in order to order them to appear in person in those situations. But the vast majority of the time, virtual works very, very well for us, at least in some context. We're doing a hybrid session, so we do have, I'm usually in the bench or on the bench rather in the courtroom, and we'll have half the people that are appearing virtually and half the people that are appearing in person. Everybody can see and hear everybody else. We make sure that that is the case, and that seems to work very, very well in most instances. Are there technical glitches from time to time? Absolutely there are. You know, are there issues that call upon me to ask to continue the proceeding so that we can all be in the same room at the same time? Absolutely, that happens as well. But again, it is a tool that we have found very, very helpful with our court, with our court personnel, with the attorneys that appear before us, and with our litigants as well.
In my jurisdiction, we're doing hybrid as well. And so the majority, they have one of the biggest problems we had with making it not presumptive, is all the attorneys having to file requests for it to be virtually. That was Judge Bishop didn't want to have to be constantly approving motions to appear virtually because we're going to grant it anyway. So we thought maybe we could address it in local order, you know, to do it that way. But ours are virtual as well. And there are times that I've had to stop a hearing and say, we're not doing this. All parties need to be in the courtroom with me in order for us to finish this. But it's been very, very beneficial. And my failure to appear rates have dropped significantly for the minor, you know, traffic tickets and, you know, even some of the more petty. Significantly.
Judge Tyrus, you're down for virtual preliminary hearings. Is that a mistake, or is there?
You know, we've had virtual preliminary hearings, and by default, I would prefer that they be virtual. If it is something where the facts and circumstances are such that I need to have the people in the courtroom, I will go ahead and exercise that discretion, order them to be in the courtroom. But we've been very successful in our preliminary hearings. Now, admittedly, we don't do a ton of them. So, you know, we're talking about a couple a month, you know, that's our volume, but it really has not been a problem.
So one other point I wanted to jump on, Judge Mathis mentioned the filing of motions. That's another issue that services with the practitioners. Do I have to file a motion in this judge before this judge, and I don't have to file a motion in front of this judge? I mean, the paperwork is nuts. And frankly, by insisting on all these motions to resolve all these issues, we increase the cost, but we also increase your workload. You've got to read them all and decide them all if you're insisting on them. That's why I think there is a benefit associated with having these presumptive rules in place and getting rid of all of these motion practices in order to solve these. Any other comments about the limited jurisdiction breakdown here? You have a lot of X's in which you're undecided. I wondered what it would take to get some of those X's into either one of the other boxes.
splitting it into a large the size.
Okay.
Rural
versus urban, maybe.
Right. It's literally the size of the courts. I really believe that's why it went to undecided.
Gotcha.
I'm not handling as much.
And I understand that. I get it.
And Justice, there are strong opinions on either side. It would be challenging. I mean, certainly it's possible on some of these matters, you know, there could be a consensus reached, but it would not be unanimous. I think it would be, I think that's why the only thing we could agree on is that we disagreed on a lot.
Well, I think that's an understatement with respect to the entire commission, frankly.
And I think something that might be noteworthy is, I'm sorry, Justice Hearn.
Oh, that's okay.
I'm sorry.
I was just curious, with preliminary hearings, when you said you've done them virtually, did that mean everybody was virtual?
Yes, I've done them where everybody is virtual.
How did you handle the introduction of evidence at those prelims?
Well, depending upon the form of it, a lot of times we had the attorneys, if it was documentary, you know, that we had the attorneys go ahead and share their screen, put it up on the screen. That way, it also made a record of that particular document as well. The vast majority of everything that we do look at from an evidentiary perspective is documentary. So it really, I'm trying to think if there's any instance where there was physical evidence that created an issue. I have had other trials where we have had physical evidence, and I've said, okay, we need to bring everybody in so that we can examine this all together. But if it's documentary, you know, we can read it on the screen just as well as the piece of paper, you know, and the way it's presented, it also becomes a part of the record.
So when you say documentary, you're just referring to things that were used to like refresh somebody's recollection, not that were being introduced as a physical item of evidence.
Generally speaking, that is correct. Although there may be, you know, there may be some documents that are related to, you know, the particular matter, you know, that are actually admitted as evidence. And in that case, you know, we do have it in electronic form and we do note it appropriately.
Okay.
I'd like to ask Mr. Lawley, Ms. Noble, Mr. Imlay, and Ms. Thomas, are you required to file motions with respect to whether a hearing is going to be virtual or not with your judges in your criminal cases in the 8th?
Generally, it's my understanding that there is some variance from department to department. Of course, I'm talking about the trial deputies. So they may have to file a motion if they seek a virtual hearing. For my cases, a lot of times the court will just tell us whether or not we're going to handle a post-conviction hearing or matter virtually or in person. But it does appear in like serious evidentiary hearings, for example, in capital cases, those are going to be all in person. And if somebody wants any part of it to be hybrid, they have to file a motion. I hope that's clear, but it may not be.
No, that's fine. But there are differences between and among judges within the second on the other cases.
That is my understanding in talking to the line deputies, yes.
Chris, how about you guys?
My understanding is it's sort of the same as in the Washoe here in Clark. It's sort of some judges require some things and other judges don't. I know if we at the grand jury, for example, use the virtual testimony of a witness, we normally file some documents with the district court. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if Jonelle, your experience is different from that. I know our judges have rules where, for example, we have our specialty team attorneys. If they want to, if it is a very routine sort of status check, they can attend that status check from their offices, so they can sit in their office and do work as opposed to sitting in court and not doing anything. So in that regard, I know it's very helpful, but I'll also kick it over to Jonelle.
So most of my clients are in custody, and the detention center really struggles with having some people at the detention center appearing virtually and some people in person. Mm-hmm. So we tend to be I would say 95% in person. And it's important to me that my attorneys be with the client during court proceedings if there's anything substantive going on. There are some exceptions. Some status checks. Sometimes a client who's out of custody will be sick and will show up in court that morning and say the client's sick, but they're on video, which I think is better than the client not appearing at all. If a client is out of state waiting for charges, we'll have them appear. We probably do that by email, just give a heads up to everyone that that's when what we're planning on, and if someone's got a problem with it, they will let us know. I don't think we've done any preliminary hearings virtually on any major issue, in part because of the custody issue, but also if the state's wanting to preserve testimony through the preliminary hearing testimony to be presented at trial, I would be arguing that the client's confrontation rights were violated, absent some compelling reason for them not to be in person. So I think, I can see that there are times if it's a minor witness, if it's a custodian of record or something pretty basic, but if it's an eyewitness ID, I'm going to want them in the courtroom, and would not be agreeing that a virtual is enough to preserve that testimony for later use in light of the confrontation rights. So I know that was a lot. There's also a couple of situations, though, that are different. We've got an agreement for high-risk transport clients who get their own CERT team. We're trying to do those virtually just to save everyone the drama involved in the transport. If someone's got COVID but can enter and appear or do a simple thing through an iPad if they're in custody. But I think most of the time, we're just able to work it out with the attorneys on the case and the judge without a lot of dispute between the parties or the court.
This is Darren, Emily, and Clark.
Yeah,
I'd agree to most of those things as well. But anything as far as a preliminary hearing, anything with evidentiary value, evidentiary hearings, trials, bench trials, misdemeanor jury trials, where the witness needs to be in the courtroom, the presumption is that it is virtual or it is in person. There would have to be a motion, whether it's oral or written, to do it virtually. That would have to be addressed by the court, but the presumption will be it's in person for all evidentiary type hearings or substantive hearings.
Great. But one follow-up question, Darren, are your lawyers having to file motions with the judge if they want a virtual hearing, or if it's virtual, they want it in person? Are you having to file motions on those topics?
Only if it's an expert witness or it's a witness that lives out of state, rather than fly them in, there's going to have to be some type of motion. And a lot of times it can be done virtually orally well in advance, especially if there's been some type of agreement, just to get the court on board with that. But the presumption, again, is that it's always in person for anything that's contested at all.
Chief, we didn't really, in our subcommittee, we didn't address how you would get something virtual if it's presumptively in person. And in my mind, it was intentional that we didn't come up with a specific recommendation for that. Since we started with the proposition that judges will be in the courtroom during the work week, if it's presumptively virtual, you always have the right to just show up in person. You certainly don't need to make any special request, motion, et cetera, to come in person. So the only issue would be if it's presumptively in person and for some reason there's a need to do something virtually. In my mind, it would probably be resolved most of the time by, Leslie calls Chris and says, I'd like to appear virtually. And Chris says, no problem. Let's let the judge know. And the judge says, yay or nay, based on something going on with that particular hearing. And if it needs to be in person, maybe they end up continuing the hearing. So there shouldn't be a need to be papering people to death about filing motions for that. I can see where maybe there would be two people really dug in on something going on and they decide to file a motion over it. But I would think that for the most part. It should be the old-fashioned, people call each other and work the issue out, and then they go to court.
I agree with that. And I think that's genuinely the way it works more often than not. Every now and then, there is disagreement between our office and DA's office. Yes, that's going to be addressed in a hearing before the judge. But we're not filing a written motion every time we want to do something virtually. Generally, it's agreed to by the state, and the courts are on board 9 times out of 10.
Yeah, I agree that's how it should be handled as well, without the need for filing motions.
Do you or Tara, I mean, or do you know of any judges that are requiring people to file motions in the district courts in the 8th?
There is a couple of judges who are requiring it in a civil context. I am not aware of anyone who's doing it in a criminal context. I agree with everything that's been said by the criminal justice partners. They usually have it already worked out. I have had the state file motions to have a witness testify virtually before a jury trial. But as far as like parole and probation routinely appears virtually for revocation hearings now, because it's easier for them than having to come to the building. And I haven't had any objection from the defense, but we do have an understanding. I know I do with them. If there's something for which they need that person here in person, we'll agree to continue it. And if it's P&P, the state will get them here, or the defense has a witness, then they can bring them in.
Ms. Perrell.
So I have a question for the subcommittee, this criminal subcommittee. There's on a few of the exceptions and comments, it says that there should still be a virtual option for the public and or the family of the victim or the defendant. Was it contemplated that the court would be publishing a link to each of the proceedings? Or I'm just curious how that would play out in real life. is it something that the prosecutors would be similar to maybe the Marcy's Law requirements for notification of the victims? Just how exactly would that be provided? And especially if we're talking about the public having access, it could get a little sticky. I'm just curious if maybe technically we've thought about that.
So it kind of goes back to first the presumption that judges will be in the courtroom. So the courtroom's always open. So the public or anybody else that doesn't have a particular connection to a case always has that right to come in and appear in person. And then just like during COVID, my sense was, and Chris, Jonelle, Jennifer, I don't know if John hopped on or not, you all can jump in on this, was the offices were getting information to crime victims and criminal defendants about the links to join by virtual to be able to watch the proceedings. Because I know we had lots of family members on both sides that would occasionally jump on. So I assumed the offices were kind of getting that out. So the only thing I guess really would be if the general public wants to join virtually, how would they know about that? Other than, I guess, you know, contacting the department that's, you know, handling a particular case. I don't know if there would be a way really, maybe there would be, you know, Tiara, within the district for the PIO to somehow have on the website, you know, who to contact if the public wanted to go about seeing how they could get into virtual hearings or something.
Justice Herndon, in the 8th, we each have our own department pages, and we had discussed early when we went to, when they first started doing these hearings, there was a separate Blue Jeans link for every single hearing.
Right.
I don't know why that happened, but we made that change and said each department would have a standing link for hearings. And so every department now just has one Blue Jeans identification. And no matter what is going on or what type of hearing it is, that's what's supposed to be utilized. And so there's nothing that would be prohibit. And I think my department does it. I don't know if anyone else does. But it is provided at every notice of hearing that we send out. It's the link is at the bottom. Should you wish to appear remotely, blah, 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 blah. Here's the link. It's on every notice of hearing. My recorder, my clerk, they all provide that information to anyone who asks. And then I think it's on our department page. And if not, it's in the works of going into our department page on the website, because I view it as transparency. And there shouldn't, if the whole premise of this is access to justice, just as much as anyone should be able to walk through the doors of our courtroom, they should be able to virtually appear. That gives an even enhanced transparency and a greater access to that justice for anyone to monitor and watch. Someone had mentioned one of the comments, the exclusionary rule. Well, the way that I handle that at trial is if there is an exclusionary rule, then we will ask anyone who remotes in to identify whether or not they're a witness or not and provide their information. And if not, they are dumped from the call. And then that's kind of what we do.
Judge Newberry, do you have civil judges in your district that are requiring motions with respect to this virtual hearing subject?
I do. And we actually have a judge that is issuing sanctions when you fail to do that.
Oh, well, that's helpful. Okay. One other thing I wanted to cover with all of you is the effort that was made by the Nevada Department of Corrections. The white paper that they did with respect to connecting inmates to the courts virtually. They have been authorized, I don't remember the full amount of money, but it's significant, to upgrade all of the broadband in the rural communities, not just for NDOC, but for everybody. But it will make NDOC's broadband capacity as good as if they were in downtown Vegas. They have authorized funding for so-called COWs, these mobile video screens that can be moved from one pod to another. I don't know, maybe some of you already know this, but in order to bring a prisoner from almost any of the prisons in the state, they have to come by themselves with three officers. When they ran the numbers on all of this, switching to virtual was a significant step forward. So my question is how the commission feels about, and I know not all cases are the same, I get that, but there is a real interest on the part of the executive branch to be able to, and frankly, on the part of a number of inmates, if you read their letters carefully, to be able to participate in the divorce court and in family court virtually. So they at least be present or testify or make their arguments from prison. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get the commission's thoughts on this so I could pass it along to both the governor's office as well as NDOC. Janelle, you have your hand up. I didn't know if it was on this topic or something else.
Actually, both. I briefly, on the prior point about courts being available by Blue Jeans, the one area I'm finding a ton of variation in is during trial. I like to watch the trials from my office or from the attorneys in my office from my office so I can get some things done while still observing new attorneys. Some departments let me watch the trials. Others are like, you have to come over. So I do think you would find a ton of variation on that access. On the prison issue, I agree. Most of my clients would prefer not to be transported. It's hard to be handcuffed for hours on end driving across the desert. They lose their belongings. They lose their cell placement. And I think most of the time, people in prison would prefer to appear virtually. As long as they're given the right to attend if they'd like, I think it would be a great program to have them appear virtually.
I know the federal judges are hoping that can be accomplished. Judge Dollinger?
So far, it's working great with parents that are incarcerated as far as their access to the video technology and Zoom platforms. So that's working really well for termination of parental rights cases. Since they're presumptively in person, but if I have an incarcerated parent, since it's their constitutional right at stake, and I'm finding that they are, for the most part, choosing to appear virtually. So if they choose that, and as long as everyone else is in agreement, then we'll do those virtually. So that's some of that
discretion, because exactly as what Ms. Thomas said, they don't want to, they lose all kinds of privileges if they have to be transported, and it becomes more difficult for them going back. But we have those discussions when setting the trials. We set mediation, settlement conference, and trial dates all at the same, out of the same initial hearing on termination cases. And we continue to have those discussions at every setting, you know, as we move forward to trial. Sure. They can change their mind. You know, I check in with them about it as we move forward. So, and also in line with what Ms. Thomas said, our local jail, the Washoe County Regional Detention Facility, during COVID and even afterwards, it was great because normally we have to get those folks on the phone, but they had great access to video. But now that a lot of judges on the gender side, and for good reason, are going back to in person, the sheriff's office doesn't have the staff to be able to man the video stations and also be transporting folks to court. So we've gone back to telephonic appearances in family court from the jail, which it's always nicer to have somebody, you know, on video for settlement conferences and things like that. But on the prison side, it's working a lot better than it had previously.
Ms. LaRue, you had your hand up. Did you want to comment?
Yes, thank you, Justice Hardesty. It's not quite on point, but it is related. And I haven't recently followed up, but for years and years in Washoe County, at least, we have had issues with incarcerated parents, NDOC incarcerated parents, being able to speak to their counsel when they're going through either dependency or TPR actions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is wonderful if those individuals will be made available via video for actual court proceedings. But for a while, it was so bad that we ended up requesting transportation literally so that counsel could talk to their client ahead of time, because otherwise they didn't have phone access to their clients. So I don't know if that is a piece that can be added into this conversation.
Absolutely.
Because it's definitely related.
Absolutely.
And it will get better for a while, and then we'll be right back where counsel can't get access again.
Well, that is a big issue, and certainly a number of the lawyers who are handling federal cases mentioned that for sure. Jonelle, do you run into that problem from your office?
We do sometimes, and prison access to clients, it changes if a warden changes and we feel like we're back to step one. We have good luck with calling caseworkers to arrange phone calls in advance so that we can have those conversations, especially some clients might get phone access at midnight that we're not going to be here. It's so if it's someone at High Desert, we'll try to go up and visit. We've had this issue generally with clients who are in trial but are in prison, and the detention center doesn't want to let them stay at the detention center. They want us to go to the prison, which is not a realistic situation. If it's a simple matter, we're calling to get a new date, or it's a limited hearing, or something pretty basic, I think virtual is great. If it were a big, long evidentiary hearing on a capital case, I would want to bring the client down.
Sure.
But in all circumstances where things are happening virtually, I think this might be an issue in Las Vegas City Court, from what I've heard, where the attorneys are in the courtroom, the client is at the jail facility far away, and there's no ability to talk by phone. I think there's got to be some phone access. Right now, if a client's at the Clark County Detention Center, we're at the courthouse, we can call into that module and talk to the client in the video room, and that works pretty well. It would be ideal if the prison could have a similar process where there's a phone in the room and we can take a break to have that conversation.
Well, that was part of the white paper, so I will follow up with that. before I leave. Okay. Justice Herndon, I think we have a substantial amount of input to discuss next steps, but probably we'll have to wait until after the first of the year to schedule a reconvening of the group. My thought is that we take this collection and these comments and develop rules for each of these categories. And then we can begin, the commission could begin wordsmithing the rules. There are a couple of sources of rules that I think the commission can look at that have been prepared by the National Center of State Courts. And I think Jamie, when she's feeling better, and Amita will be able to help us get drafts of those to work on. And then what we might do is circle back with the with that information to the subcommittees would be my suggestion, and ask them to convert their graphs or modified graphs to wordsmithing rules associated with that.
Would it be your thought that eventually we just put this forward as an ADKT? And if so, individual ADKTs? Because I think there may be some that have more, you know, input, particular areas of the bar that have more concern and input than others. So I didn't know if you wanted to do one or four different ones, for instance.
I personally am ambivalent to that, but we're already in a position, Justice Herndon, to submit a report on behalf of the commission once this wordsmithing is done, to begin the process of public hearings after that's been presented.
Okay.
So it might be prudent to, there's crossover though. So it might be best to let the court, the Supreme Court justices, have all of them in front of them at one time.
Okay.
I would think that would be best.
And can I go back and ask a question of Tiara and Tara? Yeah,
of course, sure.
When you talk, don't laugh, Tara. When you probably know what I'm going to ask, though, right? When you talk about certain civil judges want motions and are issuing sanctions, is it your sense that the request for motions is dealing with things that we're going to recommend ultimately to be presumptively virtual?
The issue is one of our colleagues takes a very strict position that the Nevada Supreme Court has a very strict rule that if you want to appear virtually, you must file a notice of appearance in the adequate time frame, and is just strictly applying the rule. And until a new rule is promulgated, she will not allow anyone to appear virtually if they are not in compliance.
Okay.
And if they do appear virtually, and there, I have heard that there have been 20 to 30 minute lectures on the record about the compliance with said rule, and then for a firm to have more than one attorney to have appeared in that way, that the sanctions get more egregious because there is a willful lack of compliance.
But if you have a sense, when the people are choosing to try and not appear in person, is it mainly for stuff that we are going to ultimately recommend be presumptively virtual? Like they're trying to get out of having to come to court for a status check or a
owner's
comp, that kind of stuff, right?
Everything.
Okay, got it.
Everything.
Just Newberry, that's the existing Supreme Court rule, right?
That's correct.
That's
why I think at one of our subcommittees I had suggested that if an administrative order or something in the interim could suspend the strictness of that, that would alleviate a lot of the complaints I think that you all are receiving from some of the civil practitioners and the inconsistencies, because there are some departments that say, sorry, the rule is the rule. You're not following it. Here's your sanction. No, you can't appear virtually. And there's other departments that said in the spirit of the AOs and what has happened in COVID, under COVID, are taking a discretionary approach of if someone calls my department and says, do I need to file a notice? My response or through my JEA is, well, the rules do require it. And then if they file it, okay. I have yet to have anyone object to someone appearing virtually. If someone appears in person and their opponent is on blue jeans, no one has ever objected to that appearance. I haven't had that happen yet.
Judge Breslow or Judge Dollinger in the second, is anybody invoking that Supreme Court rule that you're aware of to insist on an in-person hearing?
I haven't seen it.
Or have I?
Okay. Well, certainly the rule, while particularly while we're studying this, shouldn't kneecap lawyers or their clients. So I think we probably ought to take a look at some interim resolution, perhaps even a temporary suspension of that rule, Justice Herndon. Well, I appreciate that input. Does anybody have any objection to proceeding the way I outlined and suggested? We'll get into the wordsmithing here next. Okay.
Can Justice Hartsey, can I make a final comment for?
Oh yeah, sure. Uh-huh.
Yeah. On the motions, I think if it was to be researched, you will find that the motions are being asked for in the justice and muni courts, and more so.
Really?
Yeah, and to the point
why
where
do you
if,
think that is?
There, it's even posted on their websites. If you want to appear remotely, you must file a motion. It must be filed with the court within 72 hours prior to your hearing. Then even affecting pro pers for appearing for their initial arraignment or even traffic tickets, even those that will still remain criminal, they have to register and get approved to appear virtually. And that varies from court to court out in the rural. So if you're, work in Reno and live in Fernley, you don't know what to do. If that helps any, sir.
Well, that's what I'm hearing.
Okay. And then,
not necessarily Fernley and Reno, but.
Well, I'm just using it as an example,
exactly.
It's so different, but I think you're going to find that in the justice and muni courts is where you may be seeing the demand for those motions more so than even up in district court.
And do you think those motions then are predicated on the Supreme Court rule or some other argument that's being made posted?
I think it's just personal judge's preference.
Okay.
And then one final thing too, if I may, with the presumptive appearances, if we could remember as well in the rurals, I'll use a preliminary. I'm not a fan of preliminary hearings virtually, but one of the things we're also struggling with is working with the Department of Indigent Defense when we are having attorneys appointed to represent our clients. I'm in Fernley and I'm having attorneys appointed to represent my clients out of Clark County, Elko, and they're not wanting to drive in for a 5-minute hearing. So just, as one final comment, sir, thank you.
No, I think that's a serious issue. And quite frankly, we have been asking Legal Aid of Southern Nevada. We've been asking the Nevada Legal Services to pick up a number of matters in the civil side throughout the rural counties. And we've also solicited pro bono counsel out of Clark County to assist with guardianship cases in the rurals. Mm-hmm. We're not going to get that help if they can't participate virtually. We're just not.
And no.
Those people go without representation when mm-hmm. they could otherwise get it.
Right. We're struggling enough as it is. Definitely not going to make an attorney who's been appointed by the Department of Indigent Defense file a bunch of motions to appear remotely before my court.
Yeah. Okay.
So on their first appearance, I tell them you may appear remotely for all appearances with the exception of a preliminary hearing. And then we discuss what we're going to do once that hits.
Okay. All right. Any final parting comments from anybody?
Just like to say thank you for allowing me to be heard. Thank you all for the work you're doing. And Justice Herndon and Justice Hardesty, if you want to appoint me by designation for one day to break the tie on this limited jurisdiction preliminary hearing, virtual versus I will do it. I will do it unpaid for one day, although I admit I may have some preconceived bias. But aside from that, thank you, everyone, for allowing me to be heard in your in the meeting today.
I think we'd order you to do a settlement conference as well. Okay, Judge Herndon, anything as a closing comment? All right. Thanks, everybody, for your time today. We'll start pulling together some of the rules that have been developed around the country, take a look at our own rules, and begin to start wordsmithing some of this as next steps. Thanks, everybody. It's been a great discussion. I really appreciate it. Have a great
day. Hope everyone has good holidays.
Yeah, happy holidays.
Thank you.
Take care.
Happy holidays. Thank you.